Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
It is November 9th, 1921. The Potomac River off of Washington, D.C. Entering the Potomac is a very famous ship, the USS Olympia. I welcome Patrick O'Donnell, the author of The Unknowns, the untold story of America's unknown soldier and World War I's most decorated heroes who brought him home. On board Olympia is the unknown soldier. Patrick, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. The Olympia.
Good evening, John.
The Olympia is bringing the unknown soldier home. Waiting for the Olympia and the unknown soldier on Quayside are the distinguished leadership of the United States of America and 8 men who have been chosen to bear the body that day and in the next days as the unknown soldier is revered by the United States of America. The British and the French, I learned from you, have had ceremonies similar to this a year or more before. The Americans were the last. Why is that? What was the reluctance to have the unknown soldier come home from a graveyard in France? Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, John. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be with you today. The reluctance was the War Department told people, rather falsely, that they could identify the thousands of Americans that remained in Europe. And that was a pipe dream, and it was wishful thinking. And what occurs is a grassroots movement within the United States. Marie Delaney, a very famous editor of a women's newspaper, a magazine, urged her followers to look, we needed something like the French and the British. And there was a grassroots movement to get the unknown. And her movement, and then along with in Congress, Congressman Hamilton Fish, who was a white officer in an all-black unit, the Harlem Hellfighters, an incredible unit, really spearheads. He's a Republican from New York, and he spearheads the movement to get the unknown here in the United States. He wants it to honor all of the men that he served with. It's sort of his personal mission, because many of these men had not been properly honored, as well as all Americans that served in the Great War and other wars.
I note that Woodrow Wilson, who has suffered poor health these last years, on his last day in office, signs the order, the act of Congress to go ahead with the body to be brought home to honor. And we're going to tell the story of the unknown soldier, and the tomb is there in Washington now. It looks different than it did in 1921, but the same unknown soldier lies there. We're going to tell this story from the point of view of those 8 bearers of the coffin. There's a very famous photograph that covers the front of Patrick's very carefully arranged historical archive of all these events. We'll begin with Chief Gunner's Mate James Delaney. It is August 1917. Delaney's on board a ship bound for parts. It was going back and forth off the coast of France. However, it's attacked by a German U-boat. Delaney is apparently unaware that he's outgunned. Patrick, at no point did I understand that Delaney felt in any fashion that he wasn't going to win this battle. Is that your impression of him?
Delaney was a true believer in every way, and a very ardent. He believed in his men, and he believed in the weaponry that he had. And he was there to fight to the end, basically. And they fired nearly every round that they had in their magazines. And just a little bit of context, James Delaney was part of what's known as Naval Guards. And President Wilson put these guards on commercial ships to protect the ships prior to our entry into World War I, because unrestricted submarine warfare, which the Germans were waging against us, was sinking many, many ships and threatening them. And the hope was that these guards on commercial ships could defend them. And this is the hope prior to our entry into war. And then in our entry into the war in April 1917, the guards were still active on many of these commercial ships protecting them. And here we are in the summer of 1917, where James Delaney is on board one of these ships with his naval guards. And all of a sudden, U-boat 61 fires a torpedo at the SS Campana. It's a commercial ship. And that torpedo misses. And torpedoes are very precious to a U-boat commander. They don't have many of them. And the U-boat commander was an experienced commander, and he had nearly 40 kills at this point, surfaced his boat and decides to take out the Campana with his deck gun. He doesn't think that that's very – it's armed. And what you have is this running gun battle between a U-boat and a surface ship, and the two are basically chasing each other for hours and firing, and Delaney is firing every round. The eardrums on the men that he serves with are bleeding because of the concussion of the shells as they're coming out of the gun. And finally, the U-boat's very clever. They stay far enough away from the range of the guns. They're barely missing them from the Campana, but the U-boat's shells are starting to hit home, and several of them hit home on the Campana, even the engine compartment. And what they find is that they're out of ammunition, and they're really kind of out of hope for the most part, and they decide to surrender. It's the captain of the boat, the Campana, that urges Delaney and his men to actually surrender. They don't do it willingly.
Delaney will spend the next year in a prisoner of war camp in extremely poor condition near Brandenburg, Germany. We turn now to another event, another body bearer who greeted the unknown soldier that day in 1921. This is Sergeant Ernest August Jansen, born in 1878. So he's quite senior to be part of what becomes the Battle of Belleau Wood, the U.S. Marine Corps' baptism in the First War, in the late spring, summer of 1918. Jansen joined the Army, went AWOL, changed his name, and joined the Marine Corps. In other words, a hard guy, a soldier. He was with another hard guy, Captain George Hamilton, that day, born 1892, so younger. These two were commanding a unit ordered to go forward. To what end, Patrick? What is the Belleau Wood battle about?
Belleau Wood is about basically stopping the German army from taking Paris. In the summer of 1918, the Germans launched one of their great offensives. Initially, it's a diversionary offensive, but it becomes the main offensive. And there's a gaping hole in the French lines that's formed because the French are demoralized and literally are evaporating. Their units are evaporating. And it's the 2nd and the 3rd divisions, U.S. divisions, that are rushed to the front. Attached to the 2nd division is the 4th Brigade of the Marine Corps, which includes the 5th and 6th Regiments. And Ernest Jansen is part of the 5th Regiment, and he's there with the 49th Company. And they're tasked with plugging this hole, this gaping hole, and protecting Paris. And they do that. They stop the Germans cold. And on June 6th, this is sort of the D-Day of the Marine Corps in 1918. They attack and go on the offensive, and the 49th Company is crossing the wheat fields, and the wheat fields are on the other side of the wheat fields are Maxim machine guns to the hilt, and these men are being cut down in the weeds, but they're able to seize key high ground, Hill 142, and Hill 142 is just absolutely crucial because it's high ground that overlooks the forest. They take it miraculously. And the Germans want to take it back immediately. They seize this hill after sustaining a number of casualties, the 49th Company as well as another company. Germans immediately counterattack. And it's here that Ernest A. Janssen is a savior of Hill 142. He literally takes out several light Maxim machine guns that are being set up that would have swept the hill and potentially altered the course of the battle. Lets out a blood-curdling cry and bayonets these men and shoots them. In the process, though, he is he's hit multiple times, almost killed, and he is awarded not one but two medals of honor. So the man that has two names, Charles Hoffman and Ernest H. Janssen, also receives two medals of honor, the Army Medal of Honor and the Navy Medal of Honor. It's something that a practice that took place in World War I, it would later be replaced. But Janssen saves the hill and receives the Medal of Honor. And then, you know, then there's a talking to with him, and they discover his background, and he reverts back to his original name of Ernest Janssen.
So
has this incredible honor of escorting the unknown.
Two body bearers, Delaney and Janssen. The book is The Unknowns, the untold story of America's unknown soldier and World War I's most decorated heroes who brought him home. Patrick K. O'Donnell is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch. CBS Eye on the World with Patrick O'Donnell, the author of The Unknowns, the eight body bearers that greet the unknown soldier in November of 1921. It is now July of 1918, the Battle of Soissons. The man we're watching is Color Sergeant James Dell. He's field artillery, light artillery. Harry Truman was light artillery. They are using what was called the French 75, a very good weapon. 3,000 pounds, 15 rounds a minute, and they're part of an offensive launched by the French with the U.S. in support. It's the 2nd Division. Significantly here, I learn why they're unknown soldiers. It's because of the shelling, the heavy shelling. What happens to men when they're hit by those shells, Patrick?
John, the 75 is light artillery. But many of the guns in the Great War are massive artillery rounds that could crater the battlefield like a moonscape, you know, craters the size of, that could bury your a nice single family home. They were that large. You know, just imagine the devastation that those shells wrought, and they wrought on the human body. They vaporize it in many cases. And this is the reason why there are, you know, tragically unknown soldiers in World War I.
Yes, they did not have what we understand today to be a way of tracing people's identities with DNA. What they could do is have witnesses nearby to say who's that and who is that. But the unknown soldiers are legion in the graveyards in France when you go there to visit them from the First War. Many unnamed. They're unnamed in the Second War as well. It's only here in the 21st century we have details. Another battle is important. This is September 1918, and it's at sea again, the USS Mount Vernon, a mission of mercy carrying the wounded and the gassed and the damaged and those sick with what we now know to be the pandemic called the Spanish flu, carrying them home. Charles Lee O'Connor, petty officer. And that day, he's just gone below decks, I believe, Patrick. And what happens?
John, Charles Leo O'Connor has arguably one of the dirtiest jobs in the Navy. He's a coalman or a boilerman in the bowels of the Mount Vernon, which was a repurposed German ship that was seized at the beginning of the war. And, you know, we had a major problem in terms of transport ships. And this ship was German. It had gone into port as a neutral, and we detained everybody on board. But there was also another motive. It was laden with gold bullion, millions of dollars. So the ship was seized and repurposed and renamed the Mount Vernon. And Charles Leo O'Connor finds himself as a boiler man in the ship. And on September that day, there was a rainbow, which experienced mariners often looked at as either good luck or a sign of a forbidding sign, an ominous sign. And that was what it was that day. It was an ominous sign because a torpedo slammed into the hull of the Mount Vernon right near the boiler of Charles Leo O'Connor, exploding that boiler, you know, showering him with hot ash and steam and water. Millions of gallons of water rushed inside of the Mount Vernon. And it was kind of about two-thirds the size of the Titanic, to give you perspective. And it also had these watertight compartments. And what makes O'Connor so compelling is that he sort of puts aside his own safety and realizes that the watertight door to that compartment needs to be sealed. And, you know, being scalded alive and everything else, he against all odds, kind of seals that door and closes it. And as a result, many credit him with saving the Mount Vernon and his ship and all the men on board. And that's when really the challenges for the Mount Vernon begin, though, because they've got number of threats that they've got to deal with. They've got a gaping hole in their hull, which the damage control parties immediately try to patch and staunch the water that's coming into the ship. They have a active U-boat threat, and they man battle stations and depth charges to contend with that. And then, John, they, as you mentioned, they have a pandemic that is racing through the each one of the levels of the ship, and they're dealing with all of these threats at once, and somehow they do it.
And the happy end is that they get home, and that's why we have the petty officer to bear the body of the unknown soldier in 1921. Now, quickly, Saunders, Corporal Thomas Saunders from Medicine Bow, Wyoming, member of the Cheyenne Nation. He's an engineer, 2nd Engineer Regiment attached to the 9th Infantry. The offensive is launched in September of 1918 at Saint-Mihiel, ordered by Pershing to throw the Americans against a quiet part of the German line. He has wire cutters. What is his job that day, Patrick? We have about 2 minutes.
John, Saunders' job is, he's in parlance of the Revolution, he was the men of the Forlorn Hope. They were the wire cutters. They were the first men to breach the wire, which was exceptionally dangerous work, so that the rest of the infantry could pass through. There were, you know, massive bales of wire that were preventing men from breaking through. So they had to gut through them with the wire cutters and in some cases Bangalore torpedoes, explosives. And Saunders is up there up front with another man, and they cut through the wire. And what it's at Saint-Mihiel, which is a bulge in the Allied lines, in the Americans. This is their first true offensive, and they're pushing forward to remove this bulge. And they cut through that wire. They get through the lines, and they're in a position where they get deep behind German lines. And he gets into an area that is a German headquarters area it's an old chateau.
We have 30
and,
seconds.
He and
Patrick.
Another man
30 seconds.
Move through it, and they capture scores.
Right.
Over 100 German prisoners single-handedly.
Right. With the Germans give up because they're – the other man's name is Wilkerson, Al Wilkerson from Ohio. With their weapons, they wander into what is chateau and capture dozens. The Germans are reeling back from the American offensive. We're telling the story of the unknown soldier brought home in 1921 and the bearers of the coffin off of the Olympia, and then over the next 2 days until the burial. Patrick O'Donnell is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Patrick O'Donnell. The book is The Unknowns, the untold story of America's unknown soldier and World War I's most decorated heroes who brought him home 100 years ago, 1921, 2021. The final ceremony takes place November 11th, which is the Armistice Day of 1918, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. We're very carefully going through the eight bearers of the coffin greeting the unknown soldiers' remains at the quayside in the Potomac as it was brought home by the USS Olympia. We go now to another body bearer, First Sergeant Harry Taylor of the Wild West Division, raised in San Francisco, the 91st. This is the Meuse-Argonne. What is the mission that day, Patrick?
The Meuse-Argonne offensive is America's largest and arguably one of its bloodiest battles in history. It was a position where we're basically throwing over a million men at the German, the heart of the German lines that were largely impregnable for the entire war. And this is extremely tough business. And the 91st finds itself in the very heart of combat, in the heart of the German defenses, and they have to breach these defenses. And the Wild West Division is exactly that. They're drawn from men of the Western Territories, Alaska, but also the state of Arizona, Wyoming, Nevada, and even some men from California as well. And they're put together. Harry Taylor is actually a member. He's part of Cavalry, which is they have a small unit within the 91st that's part of that. And they find themselves on September 27th charging into the teeth of German guns. And later they have to take a place called Gessny, and it's really a charge of the Light Brigade is kind of putting it mildly. Battle that's really quite extraordinary.
Do they know they're up against the Prussian Guards that day? Did they have good intelligence, Patrick?
I don't think they did. This is really the first real combat that this unit has faced, and they have no idea really who they're dealing with. And they're dealing with truly battle-hardened expert infantrymen from the other side. And they do the impossible. That what's really quite remarkable is the attack was initially called off, but the runner that day on Gessny, this is a couple of days after the 27th of September, couldn't reach the regimental commander who was in charge of the attack, a guy by the name of Gatling Parker, who put himself up in the front with everybody else because he didn't want to just lead from behind. And the runner couldn't find him, and the attack went forward, and they charged, and it was a bloodbath. And remarkably, they still took the town, which was heavily fortified, and they sustained a tremendous amount of casualties. And what happened though is they literally seized the town, but their flanks are exposed, and everybody there could have been surrounded. And they were ordered to withdraw even after they had...
Right. They had gone far than the two units to their right and left, and so they had to pull back. The Meuse-Argonne was an American entirely operation, offensive. Pershing had very carefully prepared the American army to fight on its own, not to be broken up and attached to British and French divisions. And the Meuse-Argonne is a several days battle. Very famous people are involved in this. They're generals for the Second War. We go now to another very important battle that comes as part of this rolling offensive that takes place September and October. This is early October 1918, the 2nd Division, 9th Infantry, Sergeant Ed Younger. The mission here is to take Blancmont. What does that mean, Patrick?
Oh, my God, John, this is one of the most epic battles that very few Americans, unless you've really studied the First World War, know about. Blancmont was a impregnable fortress that the French spent years trying to take. And the 2nd Division, which was an elite division within the American Expeditionary Forces, it includes the 4th Brigade of the Marines, they seize it, against all odds in many, many cases. And it becomes this massive battle back and forth to take the ground. And within the context of this battle is a young doughboy from Chicago, Edward Younger. And he's a sergeant, and he's wounded very severely at Blancmont. And along with many of the other body bearers are there as well. It's kind of a focal point. Many of the men sort of cross paths either indirectly, like James W. Dell is supporting the 2nd Division with his field guns, and Saunders is there as the engineers. And the 49th Company with Jansen, he's not there, but his company is there. They make great strides on Blancmon, and they push forward into something called the box. And they're hit from like 3 sides, the German army in the box. It's just a devastating story of it's kind of like a Saving Private Ryan scene from the first scene of that movie, where their men are just hit from with mortar fire and artillery fire and machine gun fire and then gas. You know, the gas, John, is just horrendous. Mustard gas, phosgene gas, you know, constantly as they try to push forward. They're dealing with this artillery, machine gun fire, and the gas.
Patrick mentions the Marines here. Major George Hamilton is Jansen's commanding officer. Jansen is severely wounded. He's in a hospital at this point. Hamilton says that the 1/5 Marines, they went up with 1,000, and the number here is they came down with 134. That was a several days battle. Now we go to the 5th Division, 60th Infantry. Sam Woodfill, 1st Lieutenant, 35 years old, a veteran of the Philippine War. Also, he was present. He's from Bryantsburg, Indiana, Company M. He goes forward also against a fixed German position. Patrick, again and again, this is the theme here. There was no flanking. There were no uses of heavy artillery to prepare the ground. The Army and the Marines went into Maxim machine guns, which is how Woodfill found himself shooting at a Maxim position, if I understand correctly, by himself, or did he have assistance that moment?
He had assistance. He had men with him, but many of them melted away, and it was his, you know, his personal courage that pushes them forward. And Woodfill is armed with an .03 Springfield rifle, 30-06 round. He's a crack shot. He takes out a man that's in a sniper position. He takes out that machine gun nest, which is in a sort of an overwatch position, and keeps pushing forward. Just remarkable. He takes out multiple machine gun nests, which culminates in a story that's really unbelievable. He stumbles upon a shallow foxhole that is still filled with the underlying or remains of mustard gas still in there, and he is exposed. He's not able to get his gas mask on, and he keeps fighting forward, even though his face is burning and his eyes are streaming with, streaming forward with tears and everything else. And he pushes forward and takes out another machine gun nest. His 45, he uses that, and it's out of ammunition. And literally he uses a pickaxe to kill the final machine gunner in that position to save his life and to take out the nest. It's really an extraordinary story.
This is October of 1918. And the final bearer, body bearer, this is the who will meet the unknown soldier at the quayside, is Sergeant Louis Rozga. Notably, he was born in Hungary, and he joined the U.S. military. He's coastal artillery, but that becomes heavy artillery. My notes from your very careful reporting, Patrick, they were responsible for an 8-inch howitzer, M1917, that weighed 3 tons. This is the heavy guns of the American Army. Is that correct, Matt?
Yeah, John. This is sort of a really unknown aspect of the American Expeditionary Forces. These are the heavy guns. Not only this 8-inch mortar, which is a massive gun, they also had gigantic rail guns that the coast artillery of the AEF serviced as well. And these large guns, you know, went into action and did a tremendous amount of damage. Rozga, like many other members of the American Expeditionary Forces, was a immigrant. There's a large number of immigrants that fight in the American Expeditionary Forces. And he is, in the final days of the war, he is gassed. Like many of the men, and is basically incapacitated from that gas attack on his gun.
These are the 8 who greet the unknown soldier's remains at the quayside, the USS Olympia. And when we come back, the ceremony between the 9th, the arrival of the Olympia, and the final burial on the 11th of 1921, November. Patrick O'Donnell is the author. The book is The Unknowns, The Untold Story of America's Unknown Soldier. Not anymore. It's told by Patrick. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Patrick O'Donnell. The book is The Unknowns, and we're watching now 1921, 100 years before. The USS Olympia has arrived at Quayside, Potomac Basin. Eight body bearers, and we've gone through their names, Delaney, Jansen, Dell, Saunders, O'Connor, Taylor, Woodfull, and Rosga, carry the coffin. But the next 2 days are ceremonies watched by the whole nation. Certainly the newspapers covered very carefully. The leadership of the country greets the coffin. A couple of details. How was the body chosen? All these thousands of men who have been destroyed, and there's no record of their names and their origins. The choice of the body itself was designed by a man named Quackenbush. How did he imagine it, Patrick?
Well, Quackenbush is part of what's known as the Grace Registration Service, and his task is to find several American unknown. And they go to the major battlefields of the American Expeditionary Forces, which also corresponds with the major cemeteries of the AEF, where tens of thousands of Americans are buried. And Quackenbush and his detail go to several cemeteries, and they exhume what are believed to be unknown soldiers. They carefully exhume them and then carefully check the bodies for dog tags, diaries, letters, anything that could identify these individuals. Once they've found somebody that is unknown, as far as they can tell, they burn the burial ticket for each one of the remains of those people. And they brought several of these bodies back that were truly unknown to Chalon, France, where they lay in state at the city hall there. And it was there that the unknown was going to be selected by a flag officer or a general within the American Expeditionary Force, the occupation forces that were in France and Germany at this time. And the French interceded that night and said, "You really should have an enlisted man select the unknown. His enlisted men are the ones that do the fighting." And that night, an enlisted man, Edward Younger, was selected from the men that were there at the ceremony. And he was selected because of his service. Younger is kind of the quintessential doughboy. He's with the 2nd Division. We talked earlier about his service at Blancmont. He was there outside of Belleau Wood with the 2nd and went through many of the major actions of the 2nd. He was there on the night crossing of the Moose River, where the 2nd Division crosses in the final hours of the war and sustained many casualties. And it's he that is given this awesome responsibility of selecting the unknown. And I remember finding his original handwritten notes about that day. And he talks about how he prayed and he was given a bouquet of white roses and told to select from the flag-draped coffins within the city hall. And he walks in and, you know, he's just transfixed by the entire experience, but his arm, he says, literally moves towards the casket that he feels is the unknown. It might be somebody that he actually served with, he said, that had died in battle. And it was his arm moves there and it places the flowers on that casket. And that is how we have America's unknown soldier.
October 25th, Tuesday at La Havre, the casket is taken on board the Olympia, which was, I mentioned, Admiral Dewey's flagship in the Philippine War, so an honored vessel. And it spends the next days getting home in an Atlantic. And Patrick, they almost lose the body. How so?
The body of the casket itself is fairly large and significant, and they decide that they can't put it below ship. So it's lashed to the top of the deck of the Olympia, and the ship goes through a massive storm. And the Marine Corps men, the detail that was on board the Olympia, literally lashed themselves with ropes to the casket to prevent it from going overboard, and they save it. And the ship then arrives at the Washington Navy Yard. The pier is still there on November 9th. And incidentally, the Olympia is still in existence. It's in Philadelphia.
Right. I visited it as a child. It's wonderful to see the Olympia.
As have I. It's a great ship.
And the U.S. Navy is very proud of it. Now we go. November 9th, the body arrives, and the photograph on the front of Patrick's book. November 10th, thousands of mourners come, because especially families who didn't have anybody come home. And it's difficult for them to get to France, even if they know where their beloved is buried. On November 11th, the experience is everybody honors the resting place, which is not now what you see when you visit the unknown soldier. That was done in the 1930s. It was much more plain. Attending that day is leadership of the country. But one particular man needs to be mentioned here, Lieutenant Colonel Whittlesey. Who was he, Patrick? Quickly.
He was part of what's known as the Lost Battalion, and this is in the Meuse-Argonne Offensive. This battalion was cut off from American lines and surrounded by the Germans and pummeled, but they held out kind of against all odds. And Whittlesey and his men were very, just very determined, but they went through hell for many days of being gassed, going up against German flamethrowers and machine guns. Somehow though, they hold out and they survive. The Lost Battalion survives, and he is awarded the Medal of Honor along with the man that's next to him at that is marching with him at the ceremony of the unknown.
Most of these men were honored with attending a dinner with Pershing year before. This is 3 years after the end of the war, and they know each other, or they know of each other. Whittlesey returns to become an attorney on Wall Street. But that day, Patrick notes that he's sitting quietly watching this ceremony. The reason we're telling the story is that at the time, there was no language for what we now understand as PTSD. And what we're witnessing here is the tragedy that happened to Whittlesey. At the end of the month, he buys a ticket to Havana. Do we know why?
He's buying a ticket to Havana. It's a one-way ticket to end his life. And he goes aboard ship, writes a suicide note, and literally jumps overboard and is never seen again.
He talks about reliving the experiences. And Woodfill also talks about that, but does not end tragically. Woodfill goes home to Indiana, has a farm, has a life. All of them have good lives. I note how many of them lived well into the 40s, 50s. I think the oldest, the longest living is 59. Were they always remembered, Patrick, by the country?
No, many of these men, it's worth noting, John, that General Pershing hand-selected these eight men for a reason. They represented each branch of the service, and as well as different combat specializations, but he did it to tell the story of the American Expeditionary Forces through their eyes. But tragically, after their service, they're largely forgotten.
And until your work,
there was an untold story until the unknowns.
Until the unknowns, Patrick K. O'Donnell telling the story of the unknowns, the untold story of America's unknown soldier and World War I's most decorated heroes who brought him home. And when you visit the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, you'll know 100 years before, you'll know that the country that day stopped to honor the unknown. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.